again to everybody who's read and helped to start the meeting, and I'd like to welcome those that have joined us since we first started, and in particular welcome to any newcomers or visitors with us tonight. We hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So like I said, we are a speaker meeting, and it does fall on me to introduce our speaker. Gives me real pleasure to introduce this particular individual. We've known each other for a quarter of a century or more, I suspect. And I used to go up to his house just outside Bath in the West Country and meet up. He would let me drive up to London and places with his partners who were going to Region Service back in the days, ASR and ASR old. And just recently, actually, in the last couple of years, or last year or so, actually, our paths have crossed again, and it's been a real pleasure to reconnect with Paul. I'm fascinated to hear his story, and Paul is going to share with us his experience, strength, and hope of his journey for the next 40 or 45 minutes, or whatever he's comfortable with. So sit back, relax, and listen to what Paul has got to say. So, Paul, please, over to you, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You getting ready? Picking me up?
Yep.
Yeah.
Fine.
Okay, yeah. So, I'm an addict, and I am really, really, really pleased to be clean today. You know, being part of this fellowship for me has become a way of life. You know, I hear people go to meetings and say, oh, well, I need to do a few meetings. I need to get this. I need to get that. And, you know, it's a bit like a diet, you know. And for me, it's not like that. It's a way of life. You know, it's become part of me. Narcotics Anonymous, working the 12-step program. I've got a sponsor. I go to meetings and I do service, and it's great. I absolutely love it. And I go in and out of, you know, sometimes I get a bit, you know, oh God, you know, I've got to go to a meeting. I'm listen to this and see them and see that. You know, that's normal, I think. You know, sometimes I'm like that. But in the last sort of few years, I've become really, really fallen more in love with NA, really, and the whole way it works. And you know, this thing about COVID, you know, when it came and it's affected the whole world, and we're all going to meetings. It's our lifeline, really, to meet up with other addicts and to find that suddenly we can't go to meetings anymore, you know. And, you know, everyone freaked out. It was a big freak out for everyone. But we all went online. You know, I mean, I know you guys have been doing it for years. And, you know, I was saying to Steve the other day, that, you know, the future has arrived. And Steve, I think, said, didn't know the future arrived for us 20 years ago or something like that. But what I think people have, what I've noticed and people that I talk to is that, yeah, the face-to-face meetings have closed, but suddenly the fellowship has opened up worldwide. And we really, I see that it is a global fellowship that we're part of. You know, we carry this message, you know, part of what we do, the main thing of what we do, the way we stay clean, the way I stay clean, is by giving it away, by carrying the message and talking to people in all different countries all over the world. You know, that thing about our common welfare comes first, you know, NA recovery depends on NA, you see. Common welfare, what have we got in common? Well, we're all addicts. It don't really matter where you're from. And you know, that's one of the amazing things about this program, really. You can be whoever, you know, you can look however you can have an accent, you can, it really doesn't matter. The fact is that you're an addict, and if you're an addict, I can help you, you can help me, you know. And that's remarkable, really. And it's amazing how everything falls by the wayside because we have that focus in our lives, you know, that common welfare, you know. So it's great to be here, and you know, it's I'm just going to sort of ramble on about my where I come from and how I got into the fellowship. You know, I mean, I come from London, and I live in Essex now, in Southend-on-Sea. I've moved here about 3 years ago, but I did live in the West Country for many years, and the reason that came about is because I went into a treatment, so I went into rehab, a treatment centre. In the West Country, and that's where I met Steve, you know, in Bristol and Weston-super-Mare. But I'll get to that in a second. You know, when I was little, right, it all started when I was a kid, really, and I can remember feeling that I wasn't happy with life. You know, I was one of them kids that you know, I look at it now, I look back now, and I can see it. You know, at the time, I didn't know anything, but I was very disillusioned. I was unhappy, you know, and it was partly to do, I think, with being an addict. You know, I've got an addictive personality. I think I was born with it. I don't know. But the kind of family that I come from were what you would call a dysfunctional family, meaning that they didn't know how to, you know, my mum and dad and my brothers didn't know how to talk to each other about feelings, emotions, or anything like that. And it used to go that if I kind of got it wrong, did anything wrong, you know, no one took me to one side and said, "Listen, you do this, do that." Nothing was ever explained to me. I was just told that I was an idiot for not knowing it. So, you know, I had that for years. So, you know, after a few years, you start believing that you're an idiot, that you're different somehow to other people. And I definitely felt like that. I felt like everyone else was like, you know, people talk about this bubble, where you're inside this bubble and everyone outside of that bubble is doing all right, doing okay. But me, inside that bubble, no, I was not all right. So I started to feel a lot of shame. And, you know, I heard someone say the difference between guilt and shame is that guilt is you've done something wrong, but you can do something about it, right? Shame is there is something wrong with me. So I had a lot of shame when I was a kid growing up. And I can remember going to school, coming back, having dinner, watching a bit of TV, and thinking, God, is this it? This can't be. You know, there was something wrong with all of that. You know, I needed to unlock. I needed to explode out of that, and I could never. I could never. I was just stuck in this angry, shameful world. So I used to do things like eat sweets, but compulsively. You know, I can remember just eating all these mentholiptus sweets and drinking loads of Coca-Cola. You know, my mum at the time was she went through the war. You know, she didn't really have an education. She, you know, different times back then. You know, we didn't have the information about sugar and you know what it does to you. And so she didn't stop me. In fact, she would just give me the stuff. You know, and that went on and on. And then I got to about teenager. You know, and what with all the sort of stuff that goes on when you're a teenager, or you. I can't think of it. Well, not hormones, but you're changing, and so in the East End of London, where I'm from, there was millions of pubs in the 70s, and in them pubs, they were like disco pubs. So you know, everyone used to go, and that was the entertainment. That's where everyone used to go, and I discovered alcohol, and that really was it for me because I realized that if I drank enough alcohol, I could suppress the feelings that I was having and numb them out, and it was great. You know, I'd be drunk and it was funny. So I'd arrived, really. I'd discovered a way. You know, and this is, you know, what I believe that this disease of addiction that we have is an emotional disease. Now, some people disagree with that and say, no, it's a thinking disease, or it's this, or it's that. For me, it's an emotional disease. And the reason that I say that is because to this day, I still struggle to deal with my emotions. And when my emotions get out of control, that's when the trouble starts for me. Luckily, I have the tools to be able to deal with that, you know, it's acting out and all that. And those tools are called the steps, and I work them in my life. So anyway, going back to when I was, you know, with the alcohol, it went on from there, really. And then I discovered all the other drugs that came along after that. Speed, I don't want to do a drug log, but, you know, and I associated with people that were like me. And you know, do you know what? To this day, I've still got three friends that are still alive. I say still alive. One of them lives up the road to me. He's in the fellowship. I 12 stepped him many, many years ago. He's got MS, so he has trouble walking and all that. But he's a great friend. He's still around. And I've got a couple of other friends that are still around from them days, which is really nice, you know, to have that sort of solid connection with people. It wasn't always like that, because when I started taking drugs, I became that drug fiend. I became that monster that couldn't think about anybody but myself. So I would con people. I would try and steal money from them. So those guys would avoid me at various times, along with everyone else, really. But anyway, I managed to get through. I went to college, and I don't know how I got through that, because I was a real addictive personality. You know, I absolutely any excuse to drink or to take drugs. But I did get through college. I went to art college. I've got a talent. And to this day, I'm known as a creative. So the kind of work that I do is I just come up with ideas for things, and people seem to like them, and they buy them off me, and that sort of thing. But when I got through college, I come through the other side of that, and I got a job. I worked in a design company in London, and my world just exploded with wow. You know, I'd entered this sort of amazing world of design and advertising and all of that sort of stuff. But I was this crazy addict, holding a job down, really. I worked in a design company in Covent Garden in London. And it was before the Opera House, because it's in Bow Street in central London, in Covent Garden in London, there's the Opera House. And next door was the old store where they used to keep the scenery. And underneath that were these basements, and that's where the design company was. It was a really cool place. The old Covent Garden market, you know, where they filmed Frenzy, Hitchcock Frenzy was all right. It was a very, very cool place, and there was all sorts of cool people. Anyway, I joined a club, like a drinking club, you know. And I used to go to this club all the time. It was quite hard to get into, but I managed to get into it. And we would go back to the studio. You know, we'd get completely out of their heads, and people that I worked with there was the same. I can remember one day we staggered back to the studio at, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And right in the back room, there was like a ballroom table fixed to the wall, and there was no, you couldn't really see underneath it. And I laid down under the table, like out of my head, drunk, and my friend was on the other side of the table. And then, I don't know, I think it was about 9 o'clock in the morning, the work day. And my friend got up and staggered out, and I just stayed there and went back to sleep. And then I woke up about 9:30, and the two owners of this design company were in with a client, which was actually Chrysalis Records. We used to do record covers and all that. And they were sitting on one side of the table, like with this early meeting that they was doing, and I was like lying down underneath the table the other side, and I was bursting for a wee, you know, as you imagine. And I thought, shit, they've started this meeting. They don't know that I'm here. I remember Sarah, who was one of the owners, going, God, it's that funny smell. And it's really warm in here. What's going on? Yeah, it was me. The sort of alcohol coming out my mouth, whatever. And then I thought, what do I do now? And I thought about crawling out from under the table to the door, right, and hoping that they wouldn't see me. And then I thought, no, that would just be too weird. So I thought, well, I've just got to announce myself, you know. I always remember three of them sitting there, and I just popped up from the other side of the table, and I always remember their faces looking at me, and I went, hello, you know, and I didn't know what to say. I just knew that I had to get out of there, you know. And I was like in shock to think that I'd been lying under the table all this time. And I said, can I get you anything? Do you need a coffee or anything like that? And they just sort of stared at me, and I just walked out, you know. And the reason I say that is because that's the sort of madness of me use, you know, what it was, you know, who would do that, you know? And then I would go to a party, and I can remember being at a party, and I remember there was these sort of people there, like sort of student teacher type people, hippie sort of people, and they were smoking joints. They had these little tiny one skin joints with homegrown, you know, it was like bright green grass, and they was all smoking it and giggling and having a great time. And it made me really, really angry, right, because they were taking drugs as a recreational thing, and they were like enjoying it, you know, and I hated that because I couldn't do that. So what I would do is I would sit and I'd build the biggest joint ever with seven skins, you know, and we used to get this stuff, this oily, I think they call it skunk these days, you know, but it was that oily weed, you know, and like you just get near it and you're stoned, you know, let alone puff it. And I'd smoke that joint with my mates, you know, and going, oh, this is how you take drugs, you know, them guys, they don't know what they're doing, who do they think they are? And I'd sit there puffing on this big joint, and then I'd spend the next 3 hours working out how I was going to walk to the toilet without anyone looking at me, because I was completely paranoid, you know. But I was angry. I was angry that those people were normal, as far as I'm concerned, and I wasn't. I didn't know how to do it. I was self-obsessed, angry, and that, you know, that's, and gradually my life kind of slipped away from me. You know, I had a few material things. I was married at the time, and after that, I had a very good job in an advertising agency, one of the big ones in London. And I had a very, very flash lifestyle. It just sort of landed in my lap, really, because I'm good at kind of like account directors used to lock me in the office and say, you're not coming out until you've cracked this particular ad campaign and whatever. And I'd do it, and they liked what I did, you know. So I carry, you know, I could carry on, you know. So that all happened, and then gradually I just lost everything. I got on the Charlie on cocaine and discovered heroin. I think heroin really brought me to my knees. So I don't really want to do a drug along, because this, you know, we're about addiction, aren't we? We're not about any. Hello? Who's that? Is it anyone else hear that? Is that someone screaming or?
Yeah, I we've got we're getting some trolls. Just ignore it.
Oh, okay. All right, I'll carry on. So where was I? So I was on my knees, and that was the end of that, really. I kind of lost everything, and it was a terrible, terrible, you know, talk about rock bottoms, and I had various rock bottoms, but you know, I ended up just on the floor with nothing. I lost everything. You know, my wife, we split up. I had no material things left, and I am one of them people that really, really went to the to really bad places. I ended up living on the street in London. It was like falling off of a cliff, because I had quite a good sort of I had a house and all of that, and it all went, everything went, and I think I had a bit of a nervous breakdown at that point. Like the expression on my face was just shock. I couldn't cope. I ended up going back to my parents' house. They took me in, but then after a while they chucked me out, because they said to me it was like living with a terrorist. I was that out of control. And at the time, and I talked about before, the shame really was thinking, God, this is me. I'm a really, really bad person. I mean, I stole money off my dad, off my mum, threatened people, all of that stuff. I was using intravenously, which I said I'd never do, but I did in King's Cross, with all sorts of people that were on the game, like prostitutes and things like that, sharing needles. Well, that was bad. It was really, really bad. And then my brother stepped in, and I went home, and my mum and dad was there and everything like that. And he said, look, we can get you into treatment in Weston-super-Mare. And I thought to myself at the time, what have I got to lose? And I honestly thought that I was going down to Weston-super-Mare, which is a place in England, which was a bit of a treatment town. There was a few treatment, rehabs there, treatment centres. I thought that they were going to teach me how to use drugs properly. That's what I thought that they was going to happen. I thought I was going to be there 2 years, and I thought that, 2 weeks. I thought I was going to be there 2 weeks. Did I just say 2 years? I thought I was going to be there 2 weeks, and then they'd teach me how to use drugs, and it would all be okay. Little did I know, that was the start of my recovery, and I didn't really realise the enormity of this problem that I had. Anyway, I went into a treatment centre down there, and I mean, a lot of, we used to call it Western Super Nightmare. It's actually Western Super Mare, but we used to call it Western Super Nightmare, because we all had to face our demons, as we all have to do in when we get into recovery. We have to start looking at ourselves. So I got there, and they said to me, right, you've got to stop using drugs. And I went, oh yeah, okay, really, yeah, fine. And I mean, I know, like, every day, like for probably the rest of your life sort of thing, which is a big one, and I thought, oh okay, yeah, went straight into denial. Oh yeah, played lip service, yeah, I can do that. And then I said, but also alcohol is a drug, you know that, don't you? You can't drink anymore. And I'm like, oh really? Yeah. Okay, all right, see how we go. And they went, there's more. You need a higher power in your life, and you need to start believing in a higher power, and you need to start giving your whole life over to that higher power. And I thought, yeah, right, I'm gonna do that. Those three things I'm gonna do. Well, I will tell you now that I did those things. The miracle happened. And the way that that miracle, we talk about miracles, right? And some people don't like that term, but I do. Sometimes when I'm in the fellowship and I look around and I get fed up, like I was saying before, and I think, oh, fuck this, what I've started to do is to stop, take a step back, and just take a look around. And I do that, and I look at the people that are in the rooms. Or I hear the people that are on, on the Zoom on here, and I think to myself, my God, if I would have known all these people women was using, I would have thought it would, we've all said that. Imagine if we was all using, and we were like that now in this room or in this meeting, what would it be like? It don't bear thinking about, does it? So to think that you come from that to this, being clean, and I always say that inside every using addict, there is a productive member of society waiting to get out. You just need to, the penny needs to drop, and you need to just get hold of this program, and bang, you're on your way. And that's what happened to me. The first meeting I went to, what really hit me in the face, I suppose, was the literature. And I thought that in that first meeting, I can remember it now, I might get emotional in a minute, because when I start thinking back of what I was like and what I'm like now, it's worlds apart, you know. But I think about when I first came in, I thought they were waiting for me to, because it's all about me. I thought they was waiting for me to walk in the room to pull this literature out and go, all right, now read it. Because it was written for me, you know, everything in there was for me, you know, things like, you know, one is too many and a thousand never enough. It's like, well, fuck yeah. I'd say, you know, it just hit home straight away, right? And it's me, I didn't trust anyone at first meeting. I didn't like anyone. I didn't like anybody, you know, because I was angry, full of shame, and all the rest of it. I was a wreck. But them words, and you know, they're only words, they're just little tiny words that are written on the page by addicts, for addicts, you know, just stopped me in my tracks, really. And I would say that I definitely think NA saved my life. You know, they say when you go into rehab or into treatment, some people say it's like discovery. But going on to the program, going to meetings and going to NA is recovery. And NA, as far as I'm concerned, saved my life. Because when I couldn't do it, and I could not stay clean, as I'm sure all you people listening now will know what it's like when you cannot stop taking drugs. For me, it was because of the way that I felt. And if I took the drugs, it would numb all of those feelings out and I would be fine. I used to think, I know what would sort me out, I know what would work. And I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't, and I didn't know what to replace it with. I just didn't know. And suddenly the program was right there. And people said to me, look, if you want to use, right, just say to yourself, I'm not going to use for today, right? Just for today. Now, I started to look at that and think, I could probably do that. And that is the miracle. That is the absolute miracle for me, because suddenly I could see a way forward. I didn't have to look at next week, next year, 10 years from now. I just had to think about today. And back in at that in first early days, sometimes it was just an hour. Just an hour. And you know, like, okay, I'll just do it for an hour. And I got through. And I had people around me, you know, because they knew I was on the edge. Got through an hour, got through another hour, got a day clean. And God, getting that day clean was like the first time in my life that I'd ever, that I could remember, be without a chemical in my body. It was just unbelievable. And I carried on. You know, it kind of worked for me. The penny dropped right there, and I started to understand what the program was about. You know, and the guy doing the sharing at my first meeting I went to, you know, he said, look, this is how I do it. I work this program, and this is what I do. He wasn't saying, this is what you need to do. You need to do this. You need to do that. He's saying, this is what I do. If you can identify with this, then great. And I could identify. The fact that he was like a year clean or whatever it was, which was just beyond my understanding. I couldn't work out how anyone could be a year clean at that point, you know. But I understood what he was saying. And, you know, and we talk about the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. Oh God, is that true? Or is that true? You know, no matter what anybody says out there, any doctors or psychiatrists or anybody anywhere say, the way that this works is we help each other, you know. And when I'm helping a newcomer or a sponsee, I am giving with one hand, but at the same time, I'm receiving with two hands. That's how it works. You know, that's what Bill W. first set out when he first like created the 12-step program, you know, the way that we stay clean and sober is by helping people. That's how it works, you know. So, you know, I got it, and I like the fact that, you know, it was attraction rather than promotion, which is what we talk about in our traditions, isn't it? But then that was recovery. That was me getting into recovery, and it was the beginning of a spiritual awakening, which I've been, you know, going on that track now for 33 years, you know, which is over half my life. And as I say, it's part of my life, you know, it's my lifestyle. I don't know how long I've got. Steve, how long have I got? Am I...
Carry on. Another 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, I got into recovery and, you know, all the things that happen in recovery. First meeting, which was good. It was good for me. It was really good. And the literature, as I say, the literature just absolutely fantastic. Knocked me over, really. And just for today saved my life. And I think it's one of our oldest bits of literature. And then I realised that, so them three things that I talked about, you know, like packing up, taking drugs, alcohol, and handing my life over to a higher power, I did it. I absolutely did it. You know, if I think about now what I wanted back then, all I wanted was that desire, that pain, and that obsession to use. I just wanted that to go. And I can remember saying at the time, if that went out of my life, that would be enough. Getting in touch with some feelings here, which is no bad thing, I don't suppose, you know, because I've suppressed them for so many years that letting them out is okay. There I was in recovery. I realised that being in recovery, you know, I had to start looking at, you know, myself. And you know, the absolute amazing thing about the program, the NA program, the 12 steps, and being an addict and having an addictive personality is that there is nothing wrong with me. All those things that I did when I was out there using, all those terrible, terrible things I did because I'm an addict, and that I was powerless. And that word powerless, you know, is a big word. I could not do it any other way. And being powerless, you know, over my addiction was everything. I would have done anything to get money, to get the drugs, you know. So to learn that actually I'm not a bad person, I'm not a flawed individual, I just have this disease, you know, the disease concept, just releases it's about freedom, you know. It's a lot of our program is to do with being free from all of, you know, all the stuff from the past, you know, step four and step five and all that. And the continuation of the program is about continuing to, you know, live a sort of virtuous life, if you like. You know, I don't know if you're like me, I wake up in the morning and when I go about my day, I try and make the world a better place. And when my head hits the pillar at night, I think, you know, have I done all right? I mean, that's how I work my program. I don't see how you can work a program without being like that, you know, about having the honesty, you know, the honesty, open mind, and willingness. And I've had that all through, really. The world's got to be a better place, you know. So, but what I did realise was that I was, I had a lot of stuff to sort out. I didn't really know who I was. I probably still don't know who I am, but I'm we try a day at a time, don't we? I found myself being completely, completely obsessed, you know, so obsessed about everything when I was in recovery that I can remember We made where I used to live in Wiltshire. I suppose I was about 3 years clean or something like that. We made a rope swing in the woods where we used to live. We used to live on an old in an old house on the it was like a private woods, and we made this swing, and it was really, really high up, and I used to do this thing when I got into a car. I used to try and extract every little bit of excitement out of everything that I could get my hands on, so it was about 40 foot up in the air, and it went into a dip, and we used to call it the fuck off swing, because you used to climb up onto the little tree and jump off and just go fuck it, and hope for the best. And it was so exhilarating. We used to do it at night, because you're just jumping into this sort of, dark abyss and going through the air. It was an amazing buzz. We used to do, there's a little group of us in recovery, and I tell you, they were golden days. Get into recovery, you've got all the shit behind you, you've got this new life, and life was for living. Back in the first couple of years of my recovery in the West Country, in the UK there. And one day, some people came down from London to visit, and I got on the swing to show them how it worked. And I got on the swing, and as I swung out, just as it sort of got halfway down, it snapped and it catapulted me into the woods. I just flew up in the air, and I hit the floor. I hit like a stream, and I remember, so it knocked me out for a minute, but I was still holding a rope in my hand, in a stream, thinking, why am I wet? It was, and I'd knocked my head, and there was a bit of blood and everything, and all the people that was there would come running down to see if I was all right, and my friend said to me, what was funny was, you was just sort of soles at your feet, but they kept the same altitude, and you just flew through the air. He said it was really amazing. But the first thing I said wasn't, oh shit, I said, how did I look? That was important to me, how I looked, because I was that self-obsessed, And there was another time when in Bath, it was a place in the UK, we used to go out and have fun and everything on a Sunday. And I can't remember, I'm not a good swimmer. In fact, I'm a terrible swimmer, and I can't tread water and all that. We was all, and I got in the water, and everyone was sitting on the bank watching and everything like that. And the current took me from under my feet. It took me up the river a little bit, the River Avon. And suddenly I was gone. I couldn't touch the bottom, and my head was bobbing about, and I was splashing around, but I couldn't bring myself to say, help, I'm drowning, because I was too self-obsessed. I didn't want anyone to know that was what was happening. And I was a bit like like you see a swan, and they're all graceful. My head was all, smiling. Underneath, my legs and arms were thrashing about, and my foot caught a bit of rock underneath, and suddenly I was back with a land of living, if you like, and I managed to grapple onto the side, and I just walked out of the water, and all the people sitting on the bank going, you okay? Yeah, fine. I'm saying the self-obsession, that I used to go through in early recovery. It's not so bad these days, but it can be at times. It can be, it's like you take your eye off the ball, you're off the program, and you go nuts, don't you? Yeah, I do anyway. I can be driving along, bit of road rage or whatever, and if I'm not thinking about the program and stuff, I turn into a complete lunatic. I want to start fighting with people and acting out on everything like that, because I'm a mad addict, really. And it's all about having the steps, the program, to keep me in line, really. The other thing that goes on with me. Is I have, and some people call it Tourette's of the mind. Okay, but as funny enough, a lot of people in NA that can identify with what I'm about to say. Right now, I can remember being in a meeting, a business meeting actually, and it was very important. And the guy that came in had a lovely beige suit on, nice tie, and we was talking about business, very, very important. Cup of coffee, cup of coffee. And I'm sitting there, with the coffee in my hand. And he's talking to me, and all that was going through my mind was, throw the coffee over him, throw the coffee over him, just throw it over his suit. In this madness, in and I would do everything to stop myself from doing that, right? You know, I've never acted out like that. But it's similar to being on a train platform in London, you know, the underground, the subway. As the train comes in, I have to stand back because that madness in my mind, little voice in the back of my mind, just says, jump. Now, I don't want to jump in front of a train, and I don't know where it comes from, but I have this madness in my head, and it's part of the kind of insanity that goes on with me. And that's why I go to meetings. You know, I go to a meeting. Every time I go to a meeting, I'm working a step two without even doing anything, because I'm listening to what people are saying, and somehow or the other, everything falls into place about halfway through a meeting. And I remember, that, yeah, because when I first go to a meeting, I think no one really wants to hear what I'm saying. No one likes me. I don't like them. You start making all this stuff up in your head. You get halfway through the meeting and you realise that actually I belong to a loving fellowship where people love me. And they want me to do okay. They don't want me to relapse, and they don't want me, you know, and they identify with me. And that's the fellowship that I'm involved with, that I go to. It's just that, you know, I've got these voices in my head that tell me that are only there to ruin my life. And I think it's part of being an addict, you know. I wake up in the morning, I've got like, it's like a whole department of people that live inside my body working out ways that they can screw me up to tell me to do all, you know. I've got a disease that tells me that I don't have a disease. You haven't got a disease. Well, I have got it. No, you don't. You can do this, you can do that, you know. Why don't you do telling me everything wrong, that you know. So I have to go with my gut feeling and you know, just ignore it. These days I just ignore it. You know, it's just interesting. It's always there. It's always there, really, you know. It's just I've got into the habit of learning how to, you know, live my life. I laugh at it, really. Yeah, I have a laugh. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say was that group of people that we when we used to do all those things in Bath, we went to a thing called grass skiing. We found this place and there was about half a dozen of us. And what it is, it's like rollers, big roller things, like a tank track or something on the bottom of your feet. It's all these wheels with a track around it. It's called grass skiing. And you're literally as if you're skiing on snow, but you're skiing on grass, you know. So we got there, you know, looking up, and there's this wire that pulls you up the hill. And we all arrived there, and the woman said to us, okay, so is it your first time? We said, yeah, we've never been here before. Right, do you want the ordinary skis? Or do you want the fast skis? Or do you want the very fast skis? So we went, well, the very fast skis, obviously. Okay, now we've got tuition. So we can teach you this in 10 minutes, or you can have a different type of tuition, or you don't have to have tuition at all. We said, no, we don't want any, we don't want any of that. We'll just crack on, you know. She went, are you sure? You know, typical of us, isn't it? You know, that no, we don't need any tuition and we want the fastest bloody skis that you've got, you know. And we got up there and we all fell arse over head coming down the hill, tumbling. We was there for hours and she had to close. She said, look, I've got to close. And we went, all right, let's just have one more go. And we all stood at the top of the hill and we all skied down the hill and we was all like really, you know. And she went, wow, you look like club skiers, you know. She said, where are you from? And I mean, NA, because that's what we're like, aren't we? That is what we're like. So, you know, those were the early days of recovery for me. I don't know if have I reached my time, Steve, or am I?
Just a couple of minutes, Paul.
Oh, right, okay, I'll finish up then. I'll finish up with a couple of things just to finish off with. So in the time that I've been in NA, I do service as well. And I've almost done service really, because as I say, NA saved my life. And you know, if it saved my life, then I want to save other people's lives, you know. And the way that I'm going to do that is by making sure that these meetings work and that they're there when people expect them to be there. I've done service at the Area Service Committee, and I did service at the region, the UK region, and I was actually on the PI committee in well back in the day when we decided we need a website many years ago. And we, you know, I've got all the minutes from that meeting where we voted to go live online. As I say, it started with public information, and we went live online, and we created the first kind of website, which has now turned into the most amazing website that it is now. It's called the Comms Committee now, and it's its own committee. It's not part of PI anymore, but it's nice to kind of be, you know, sort of instrumental in some ways, to help make that happen, back then, you know, for the UK. And going to the Area Service Committee and places like that, and I know that's where I saw Steve at the region about a year ago, has taught me, going to the Area Service Committee has taught me more about being an addict, living, you know, drug free, being clean in this world. Because I don't find it, I don't, you know, people say, I don't find this program easy, I find it difficult. Well, I don't say that. I find life difficult. I think life is, the program's easy, it's simple. You just need to work it, you know, just really keep it simple and work. It's life that's hard. It throws all this stuff at you, and you've got to know how to fucking deal with it. And the program helps to do that, you know. But I've learned so much by going to committee meetings, and it's not everyone's cup of tea, I know that. But in the workplace, it's benefited me. I've learned how to. You know, if when I first sort of went to my first committee meeting many, many years ago, when I first got clean and that, if someone disagreed with me, I wanted to throw the table up in the air and start screaming and shouting and having a fight because they disagreed with me. You know, I used to think that everything was personal, everything was, you know, they were having a go at me, they were maliciously trying to stop me from doing all this shit. And you know, there's a lot of newcomers like that. It takes time to come away from that, and that the beauty of this kind of service structure, if you like, in Narcotics Anonymous, is that we say this thing, which is principles before personalities, you know, and that is amazing. And it's, yeah, having that under my skin and being part of me is that I'm able to say what I feel is right without getting involved with personalities. And I'm always sort of upsetting people by putting my opinion across and then taking it. And I have to say, it's not personal. And I have said that so many times since I've been in recovery that and then when I go out and I go to work, you know, they're all like that anyway. That, you know, the difference between us lot in the fellowship, you know, and the difference us and people that are not, that don't have the addictive personality, is they let go of everything. And they just let go of it. But we don't, do we? We hold on to it for as long as we can. Let's give me more resentments that I can hang on. My missus, my partner, said to me, it's like you push this supermarket trolley around that's full of resentments, you know, and you just pile them in there, you know. I don't these days. I you know, like everyone, I'm always doing a bit of work on myself, and I've done a bit of work on myself over the years, and I find myself letting go, just let go. It doesn't matter, you know. I go to meetings in Essex, in London, places like some, you know, we do service, and some people disagree, and you fall out with this one, and they argue about that, and I just let go of it and just think, let's just carry on. It doesn't matter if we disagree; we can still just be friends, you know, and that works for me. It's a relief. Again, it's a release. It's freedom. You know, I don't have to have a resentment. You know, and sometimes I can't even remember what the resentments were for. You know, just angry. You know, anger. That's a whole different thing, isn't it, really, which I've had to work, because I remember when for the first part of my recovery, people used to say to me, are you angry? And I just go, no, oh no, I'm not. Obviously I'm angry. No, I'm not angry. For a long time, a long time I did that. And then one day somebody said to me, you are angry, And when we say to you, are you angry? Why don't you say yes? And I said, well, why would I do that? And they said, well, because you are angry, And I go, all right. And one day someone said, are you angry? And I was obviously angry. I went, yes. And something happened, right? Something just amazing. Like, this program is amazing, isn't it? And these little moments of insight happened. And I thought, my God, I am angry. And I've just admitted it. So I've come, I come out of denial. I've been in denial for years. And suddenly I come out of that denial thinking, I am angry. And I always associated anger with smashing things up and aggression and all that. No. You don't have to need any. If you're angry, just say, I'm angry. Yeah, I'm angry. I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah, I can be angry. Yeah, fine. Anyway, that's about it. I hope that what I've said is, I feel like I've just rambled on, but, I've given you a bit about my life, what I'm about. I hope I haven't come across as being whatever. I just hope you've got something from it. And I will just say to you, God bless you all. And thanks for asking me to share. Thank you.